Chapter 33. Hiram Yeager swam deep in the blue depths of the sea, the water rushing past in a blur, as if he were in a jet aircraft flying through tinted clouds. He swept over the edge of seemingly bottomless chasms, soared through valleys of vast mountain ranges that climbed from the black abyss to the sun-glistened surface. The seascape was eerie and beautiful at the same time. The sensation was the same as flying through the void of deep space. It was Sunday, and he worked alone on the 10th floor of the deserted Numa building. After 9 straight hours of staring steadily at his computer monitor, Yeager leaned back in his chair and rested his tired eyes. He had finally put the finishing touches on a complex program he had created using image synthesis algorithms to show the three-dimensional propagation of sound waves through the sea. With the unique technology of computer graphics, he had entered a world few had traveled before. The computer-generated drama of high-intensity sound traveling through water had taken Yeager and his entire staff a week to calculate. Using special-purpose hardware and a large database of sound speed variations throughout the Pacific, they had perfected a photorealistic model that traced the sound rays to where convergence zones would occur throughout the Pacific Ocean. The underwater images were displayed in extremely rapid sequence to create the illusion of motion in and around actual three-dimensional sound speed contour maps that had been accumulated over a 30-year study period from oceanographic data. It was computer imaging taken to its highest art form. He kept an eye on a series of lights beginning with yellow and advancing through the oranges before ending in deep red. As they blinked on in sequence, they told him how close he was coming to the point where the sound rays would converge. A separate digital readout gave him the latitude and longitude. The pièce de résistance of his imagery was the dynamic convergence zone display. He could even program the image to raise his viewpoint above the surface of the water and show any ships whose known courses were computed to bisect that particular sector of the ocean at a predictable time. The red light farthest to his right flashed, and he punched in the program to bring the image out of the water, revealing a surface view of the convergence point. He expected to see empty horizons of water, but the image on the viewing screen was hardly what he'd imagined. A mountainous landmass with vegetation filled the screen. He ran through the entire sequence again, beginning from the 4 points around the ocean that represented Dorset Consolidated's island mines. 10, 20, 30 times he reran the entire scenario, tracing the sound rays to their ultimate meeting place. Finally satisfied there was no mistake, Yeager sagged wearily in his chair and shook his head. "Oh, my God," he murmured. "Oh, my God." Admiral Sandecker had to force himself not to work on Sundays. A hyper-workaholic, he ran 10 kilometers every morning and performed light workouts after lunch to work off excess energy. Sleeping but 4 hours a night, he put in long, grueling days that would inflict burnout on most other men. Long divorced, with a daughter living with her husband and 3 children on the other side of the world in Hong Kong, he was far from lonely. Considered a prime catch by the older single women of Washington, he was inundated by invitations to intimate dinners and parties of the social elite. As much as he enjoyed the company of ladies, Numa was his love, his passion. The Marine Science Agency took the place of a family. It was spawned by him and bred into a giant institution revered and respected around the world. Sundays, he cruised along the shores of the Potomac River in an old Navy double-ender whaleboat he had bought surplus and rebuilt. The arched bow brushed aside the murky brown water as he cut the wheel to dodge a piece of driftwood. There was history attached to the little 8-meter vessel. Sandecker had documented her chronology from the time she was built in 1936 at a small boatyard in Portsmouth, Maine, and then transported to Newport News, Virginia, where she was loaded on board the newly launched aircraft carrier Enterprise. Through the war years and many battles in the South Pacific, she served as Admiral Bull Halsey's personal shoreboat. In 1958, when the Enterprise was decommissioned and scrapped, the aging double-ender was left to rot in a storage area behind the New York shipyard. It was there Sandecker found and bought the worn remains. He then beautifully restored her with loving care until she looked like she did the day she came out of that boatyard in Maine. As he listened to the soft chugging from the ancient four-cylinder Buddha diesel engine, he reflected on events of the past week and contemplated his actions for the week to follow. His most pressing concern was Arthur Dorset's greed-inspired acoustic plague, which was devastating the Pacific Ocean. This problem was closely followed by the unanticipated abduction of Pitt and Giordino and their subsequent disappearance. He was deeply troubled that neither dilemma was blessed with even a clue toward a solution. The members of Congress he had approached had refused his pleas to take drastic measures to stop Arthur Dorset before his guilt was ironclad. In their minds, there simply was not enough evidence to tie him to the mass deaths, reasoning that was fueled by Dorset's highly paid lobbyists. Par for the course, thought a frustrated Sandecker. The bureaucrats never acted until it was too late. The only hope left was to persuade the president to take action. But without the support of two or more prominent members of Congress, that was also a lost cause. A light snow fell over the river, coating the barren trees and winter-dead growth on the ground. His was the only boat in sight on the water that wintry day. The afternoon sky was ice blue and the air sharp and quite cold. Sandecker turned up the collar of a well-worn navy peacoat, pulled a black stocking cap down over his ears, and swung the whaleboat toward the pier along the Maryland shore where he kept it docked. As he approached from upriver, he saw a figure get out of the warm comfort of a four-wheel drive jeep and walk across the dock. Even at a distance of 500 meters, he easily recognized the strange, hurried gait of Rudy Gunn. Sandecker slipped the whaleboat across the current and slowed the old Buddha diesel to a notch above idle. As he neared the dock, he could see the grim expression on Gunn's bespectacled face. He suppressed a rising chill of dread and dropped the rubber bumpers over the port side of the hull. Then he threw a line to Gunn, who pulled the boat parallel to the dock before tying off the bow and stern to cleats bolted to the gray wood. The admiral removed a boat cover from a locker, and Gunn helped him stretch it over the boat's railings. When they finished and Sandecker stepped onto the dock, neither man had yet spoken. Gunn looked down at the whaleboat. "If you ever want to sell her, I'll be the first in line with a checkbook." Sandecker looked at him and knew Gunn was hurting inside. "You didn't drive out here just to admire the boat." Gunn stepped to the end of the dock and gazed grimly out over the murky river. "The latest report since Dirk and Al were snatched from the Ocean Angler in Wellington is not good. Let's have it." 10 hours after Dorset's yacht vanished off our satellite cameras. "The reconnaissance satellites lost them," Sandecker interrupted angrily. "Our military intelligence networks do not exactly consider the southern hemisphere a hotbed of hostile activity," Gunn replied acidly. "Budgets being what they are, no satellites with the ability to photograph the Earth in detail are in orbits able to cover the seas south of Australia." "I should have considered that," Sandecker muttered in disappointment. "Please go on." "The National Security Agency intercepted a satellite phone call from Arthur Dorset aboard his yacht to his superintendent of operations on Gladiator Island, Jack Ferguson. The message said that Dirk, Al, and Maeve Fletcher were set adrift in a small, powerless boat in the sea far below the 50th parallel, where the Indian Ocean meets the Tasman Sea. The exact position wasn't given. Dorset went on to say that he was returning to his private island." "He placed his own daughter in a life-threatening situation," Sandecker muttered, incredulous. "I find that unthinkable. Are you sure the message was interpreted correctly?" "There is no mistake," said Gunn. "That's cold-blooded murder," muttered Sandecker. "That means they were cast off on the edge of the Roaring Forties. Gale-force winds sweep those latitudes most of the year." "It gets worse," said Gunn solemnly. "Dorset left them drifting helplessly in the path of a typhoon." "How long ago?" "They've been adrift over 48 hours. Sandecker shook his head. "If they survived intact, they'd be incredibly difficult to find." "More like impossible when you throw in the fact that neither our Navy nor the Aussies have any ships or aircraft available for a search." "Do you believe that?" Gunn shook his head. Not for a minute. What are their chances of being spotted by a passing ship? Asked Sandecker. They're nowhere near any shipping lanes. Except for the rare vessel transporting supplies to a subcontinent research station, the only other ships are occasional whalers. The sea between Australia and Antarctica is a virtual wasteland. Their odds of being picked up are slim. There was something tired, defeated about Rudy Gunn. If they were a football team with Sandecker as coach, Pitt as quarterback, and Giordino as an offensive tackle, Gunn would be their man high in the booth, analyzing the plays and sending them down to the field. He was indispensable, always spirited. Sandecker was surprised to see him so depressed. I take it you don't give them much chance for survival. Three people on a small raft adrift, besieged by howling winds and towering seas. Should they miraculously survive the typhoon, then comes the onslaught of thirst and hunger. Dirk and Al have come back from the dead on more than one occasion in the past, but I fear that this time the forces of nature have declared war on them. If I know Dirk, Sandecker said irrefutably, he'll spit right in the eye of the storm and stay alive if he has to paddle that raft all the way to San Francisco. He shoved his hands deep in the pockets of his old peacoat. Alert any NUMA research vessels within 5,000 kilometers and send them into the area. If you'll forgive me for saying so, Admiral, it's a case of too little, too late. I'll not stop there. Sandecker's eyes blazed with intent. I'm going to demand that a massive search be launched, or by God I'll make the Navy and the Air Force wish they never existed. Yeager tracked down Sandecker at the Admiral's favorite restaurant, a little out-of-the-way ale and steakhouse below Washington, where he was having a somber dinner with Gunn. When the compact Motorola Iridium wireless receiver in his pocket beeped, Sandecker paused, washed down a bite of filet mignon with a glass of wine, and answered the call. This is Sandecker.
Hiram Yeager, Admiral, sorry to bother you.
No need for apologies, Hiram. I know you wouldn't contact me outside the office if it wasn't urgent.
Is it convenient for you to come to the data center?
Too important to tell me over the phone?
Yes, sir. Wireless communication has unwanted ears. Without sounding overdramatic, it is critical that I brief you in private.
Rudy Gunn and I will be there in half an hour. Sandecker slipped the phone back into the pocket of his coat and resumed eating.
Bad news? Asked Gunn.
If I read between the lines correctly, Hiram has gathered new data on the acoustic plague. He wants to brief us at the data center.
I hope the news is good.
Not from the tone of his voice, Sandecker said soberly. I suspect he discovered something none of us wants to know. Yeager was slouched in his chair, feet stretched out, contemplating the image on an oversized video display computer terminal, when Sandecker and Gunn walked into his private office. He turned and greeted them without rising from his chair.
What do you have for us? Sandecker asked, not wasting words.
Yeager straightened and nodded at the video screen.
I have arrived at a method for estimating convergence positions for the acoustic energy emanating from Dorset's mining operations.
Good work, Hiram, said Gunn, pulling up a chair and staring at the screen. Have you determined where the next convergence will be?
Yeager nodded.
I have, but first let me explain the process. He typed in a series of commands and then sat back.
The speed of sound through seawater varies with the temperatures of the sea and the hydrostatic pressure at different depths. The deeper you go and the heavier the column of water above, the faster sound travels. There are 100 other variables I could go into dealing with atmospheric conditions, seasonal differences, convergence zone propagation access, and the formation of sound caustics, but I'll keep it simple and illustrate my findings.
The image on the viewing screen displayed a chart of the Pacific Ocean with four green lines beginning at the locations of the Dorset mines and intersecting at Seymour Island in the Antarctic.
I began by working backward to the source from the point where the acoustic plague struck. Tackling the hardest nut to crack, Seymour Island, because it actually sits around the tip of the Antarctic Peninsula in the Weddell Sea, which is part of the South Atlantic, I determined that deep ocean sound rays were reflected by the mountainous geology on the seafloor. This was kind of a fluke and didn't fit the normal pattern. Having established a method, I calculated the occurrence of a more elementary event, the one that killed the crew of the Mentawai. Now, that was off Howland Island, almost dead center in the Pacific Ocean, commented Sandecker. Far simpler to compute than the Seymour convergence, said Jaeger, as he typed in the data that altered the screen to show four blue lines beginning from Kunghit, Gladiator, Easter, and the Komondorski Islands, and meeting off Howland Island. Then he added four additional lines in red. The intersection of convergence zones that wiped out the Russian fishing fleet northeast of Hawaii, he explained. So where do you fix the next convergence zone intersection, asked Gunn. If conditions are stable for the next 3 days, the latest death spot should be about here. The lines, this time in yellow, met 900 kilometers south of Easter Island. Not much danger of it striking a passing ship in that part of the ocean, mused Sandecker. Just to be on the safe side, I'll issue a warning for all ships to detour around the area. Gunn moved in closer to the screen. What is your degree of error?
Plus or minus 12 kilometers, answered Jaeger.
And the circumference where death occurs?
We're looking at a diameter anywhere from 40 to 90 kilometers, depending on the energy of the sound rays after traveling great distances.
The numbers of sea creatures caught in such a large area must be enormous. How far in advance can you predict a convergence zone intersection? Sandecker queried.
Ocean conditions are tricky to predict as it is, replied Jaeger. I can't guarantee a reasonably accurate projection beyond 30 days into the future. After that, it becomes a crapshoot.
Have you calculated any other convergence sites beyond the next one?
17 days from now.
Jaeger glanced at a large calendar with a picture of a lovely girl in a tight skirt sitting at a computer.
February 22nd.
That's soon. Jaeger looked at the Admiral, a polar-cold expression on his face.
I was saving the worst till last.
His fingers played over the keyboard.
Gentlemen, I give you February 22nd and a catastrophe of staggering magnitude.
They were not prepared for what flashed on the screen. What Sandecker and Gunn saw on the video screen was an unthinkable event they had no control over. An encircling web of disaster that they could see no way to stop. They stared in sick fascination at the four purple lines that met and crossed on the screen.
There can be no mistake? Asked Gunn.
I've run my calculations over 30 times, said Jaeger wearily, trying to find a flaw, an error, a variable that will prove me wrong. No matter how I shake and bake it, the result always comes out the same.
God, no, whispered Sandecker. Not there, not of all places in the middle of a vast and empty ocean.
Unless some unpredictable upheaval of nature alters the sea and atmosphere, said Jaeger quietly, the convergence zones will intersect approximately 15 kilometers off the city of Honolulu.